long, so I shall zoom through. But I thought I would start by talking about what consumers have been led to expect, because I think that's one issue that hasn't come up today, is the whole background of claims around how important your genome is going to be for your health. I'm going to talk about what can be delivered, some of which Andrew Wilkie has already done a very good job on, so I'll skip through that a bit, and the extent to which scientific developments are likely to improve on the validity, utility and usefulness of those tests. And then I'm going to say something about why I think there's a regulatory gap and some of the discussions we've had about on what grounds regulation might or might not be justified. Briefly address whether I'm being a genetic exceptionalist and the conclusion. So this is just a very tiny subset of my human genome project folder from the year 2000, whereas most of you will probably remember that on the front page of every newspaper, Blair and Clinton were saluting the cracking of the genetic code. It was miraculous. It was the secret code that makes us who we are, what we are, and it was going to lead to a genetic revolution, a transformation in medicine, in which we would all be able to predict and prevent the diseases that we're going to get, and particularly with a focus on cancer. So this is from a few years later, it's just one sort of quote about the claim that we're talking about really, which is the claim that healthy people will get a routine battery of genetic tests that predict their risk of heart disease, diabetes and other ailments while they're still young and healthy, and that they'll then be able to adjust their lifestyle, diet or take preventive drugs. So I'm not questioning the usefulness of genetic research into complex diseases such as cancer and heart disease in order to try and understand disease mechanisms. But I am questioning this issue of predictability and this idea as a health strategy as a whole. But we also need to remember this has had political endorsement at the highest levels for many years. This is a quote from Tony Blair's famous Science Matters speech in 2002, the first time for I forget how many years that a prime minister had made a big speech about science. And a central part of that speech was the idea that in the future you would go to a gene sequencing machine, you'd get your reading of your unique genetic makeup, and from that doctors were involved, could pinpoint flawed genes and gene products and predict what diseases you're going to get and how to help you avoid them. And that kind of claim has not gone away. So this article's from February this year, where the chief executive of Illumina, the US gene sequencing company, was in the Times claiming that genetic mapping of babies would transform preventive medicine by 2019. And he said, well, it will all be technically feasible within 5 years, and the only reason there'll be another 5 years delay is to sort out the ethical issues. But it's definitely going to bring major benefits. There's more to the bigger picture. There's been a long history of funding in this area from the tobacco, chemical, nuclear, food and pharmaceutical industries. So I've recently done some research that's not published yet, but using internal tobacco industry documents to look at the history of the industry investment in this idea, which started in the 1950s when the eugenicist Ronald Fisher tried to blame your genes for lung cancer rather than smoking. And that idea transformed into the idea that we should have our genes sequenced in order to identify the 1 in 10 smokers who get lung cancer before they become ill, and in order to treat them so that the rest of the population could carry on smoking with impunity. So many, many scientists were funded by the tobacco industry, and many press articles promoted that idea. But there's not a significant inherited component in lung cancer. So those tests are never going to exist. You may find genes with links to lung cancer, but you're not going to have a test ever that's sufficiently predictive to say you are the 1 in 10 who will get lung cancer. That idea was picked up by the food industry, that's also funded lots of research into the genetics of obesity, the genetics of hypertension. And that's again about looking for the cause of disease, the killer in you, rather than the killer outside, so that you can find a medical or a scientific explanation and solution. And there's also been a shift to the idea of pre-symptomatic treatment promoted by the pharmaceutical industry. So a presentation by Burrell and Co. towards the end of last year, their venture capital firm that deal with quite a large number of life sciences companies, was laying out this vision in detail. And it was a vision in the US in which you'd go into Walmart, there would be nurse-led pharmaceutical centres where you could have your genome sequenced and you could get a list of all the products that you could buy to go and prevent your risk. This is in there in that plan. And it's also in a plan being discussed at the highest level in a ministerial strategy group, of which GE Healthcare, the US healthcare company, is co-chairs. So it's there right in the heart of government and in the industry. And that's because rich, well people are a much better market. So we're talking about, in that particular presentation, a prediction that the market for pharmaceuticals would double by 2020. And we're also talking about looking at medicines, foods, functional foods such as cholesterol, margarine, supplements, for healthy people instead of tackling social, economic and environmental issues. And of course there's also an interest from governments in using these tests within health services in order to create potential dual use options for DNA databases. So, in that context, the current evidence is that no genetic susceptibility tests currently meet medical screening criteria. And I admit those are not exact criteria, but there's nothing that would get through a national screening committee kind of assessment to roll out into the general population. And I've got a paper coming out in the Encyclopedia of Life Sciences that looks at some of the references in more detail. But basically, it's the evidence that Andrew Wilkie was talking about receiver-operator curves. And the even for age-related macular degeneration, I've used that one there because that's the most highly predictive multiple gene test. You're still talking about quite small percentages of the group classified at high risk actually going on to develop that condition. Which is not to say it might not be a useful test in some subgroups of people, but the idea of using that as a screening test is not particularly useful. And of course, that's one of the better ones. So testing all 18 genetic variants linked to type 2 diabetes does not improve risk prediction compared to measuring existing risk factors. And there are also some recent papers in the journal Addiction which were looking at modelling, combining multiple risk alleles and showing, again, that that isn't going to help. The more alleles you add in, you're going to get the chances of being in the really high risk group are going to become very small. So there's going to be a tailing off of predictive value. Very little, as Andrew said, of existing variants, existing differences between individuals in their risk has been explained, typically less than about 5 or 6% for these common diseases and traits. One thing that hasn't been mentioned is that if different companies are combining different risk factors, because we're talking about multiple genes and multiple alleles, then the risk prediction they give will, of course, depend on how they combine them. And you will get different information given on the basis of whether you add the risks up or multiply them together or divide by the number you first thought of. And those black boxes are going to be quite important. We also have no information on the usefulness of these tests for targeting lifestyle or environmental advice. So back to my smoking example, or if you're giving dietary advice, do you really know that that's the right group of people to advise that they have most to gain from your proposed intervention? So if the high-risk group doesn't have any more to gain than the low-risk group, then you're not actually doing any good in a population sense. I've tried to draw that in this. The idea that you're categorising people according to their genetic makeup and then according to your diet. But if you target this group who are, in this case, definitely at the highest risk, the highest risk with both their genes and diet, and you get them to change their diet, you're still not making that big a difference in terms of the impact of the disease. And in fact, the way I've made up this fake example, those individuals are changing their risk by less than these individuals would be as well. So actually, you're targeting the wrong group of people. It's going to be less useful than picking four people at random. Picking these four people is less useful than picking four people at random from that population and trying to encourage them to change their diet. So that means there are lots of problems with the existing market, and there are problems that go beyond what we've heard about from deCODE, because deCODE's genes are at least validated. They seem to be at least connected to the claimed diseases. Now, that is not the case for a lot of tests on the market. So the Janssen's paper from 2008 found significant associations with the claimed risk of disease for fewer than half of the genes included in the commercial profiles that they looked at. So that means that people are being told they have a gene that puts them at high risk for a disease when that association is no longer considered valid in the scientific literature. There's also a lack of evidence about gene-gene and gene-environment interactions referred to in that paper. We've done investigations of the Sciona tests that were marketed here in 2001, and that now the it was a UK company that fled to the US. Of NICO test, which was a genostics, is a spin-out company from Oxford University, which was claimed to have identified a nicotine addiction gene, when in the paper co-authored by the chief scientific officer found that that gene in a meta-analysis was not statistically significantly associated with nicotine addiction. We've done investigations of the Genovations test, which are tests that are being marketed, and I think they've started to be marketed again in the UK through alternative healthcare providers with supplements, advice on which supplements to take. And the tests being sold by a company called Genetic Health, that's a UK company that was marketing, is still marketing, in Harley Street. And for all those tests, we found examples, not all the genes, but examples of genes in those tests that were not statistically significantly associated with the claimed disease. There was a US GAO report that replicated some of those results as well, particularly for Sciona. So there are many, many false claims, and there are many companies that are cherry-picking from the literature, because only about 1 in 100 of these statistical association papers for common diseases actually end up being replicated over the longer term. But many of them get replicated 3 or 4 times in what is essentially a vast literature. So it's very easy to cherry-pick. But even if you move beyond that to where deCODE is, looking at these more well-established associations, there's still an issue about how much of the genetic risk you actually know about and whether those interpretations are therefore actually useful and whether they're actually going to improve health if people take those recommendations and act upon them. A lot of this marketing is also based on claims that in the future those predictions will be refined and this genetic revolution will then take place in 2 years, 5 years, 10 years. But there's some real questions about those future promises as well. So that includes questions in the scientific literature, debate about whether new gene discoveries will improve predictions at all. So the current kind of debate in the literature from last year is, you know, will we significantly improve predictions at all? And if we can, will it take, how many genes will it take? 200, 300? And the missing heritability that, again, I'm glad Andrew mentioned. I have a particular view about the missing heritability that I think that it might not exist. It's certainly true that it might not exist because it depends on the assumptions that are made when the twin data is analysed, which include assumptions that gene-gene and gene-environment interactions are not significant in those diseases. So at best, the twin studies provide an upper limit of what you expect to be the genetic component of that disease. And you can look at, and I did a mathematical paper a few years ago, you can actually look at the twin data combined with sibling data and other data, and you can say that in general, the way people's risks will be distributed in those boxes, if you try and categorise them according to their genes and their environment, will not in general provide tests of high utility. although they might do in some specific cases. So it's misleading to tell everyone that for every disease, there's going to be a simple way in which you can pick out the high-risk group and give them different advice from other groups of people. So what are the implications for consumers, which is what I'm supposed to be talking about? Well, firstly, you get multiple conflicting interpretations of genetic risks. Now, some of that is because the companies are putting different SNPs in different panels. But in the longer term, you're also going to get different results from data from different populations. You're going to get different results according to what model's being used, including whether environmental factors and lifestyle factors are thrown in or not. None of these models are yet validated. And we're at a very early stage. I feel strongly about this because my background is actually in modelling complex environmental systems, but a very early stage of considering how those models might even be validated or what the limits to their predictability is. So we have tests now which consumers are buying that involve false claims, specific false claims about associations between genes and diseases, and more general, difficult ones to pull down about living a longer life. We have no utility data, no demonstrated health benefit, and we're in a context where people are getting continued claims and years of claims of a genetic revolution and an unquestionable benefit, even a duty to go and find out their genetic makeup so that they can take responsibility for their health. So I think all the ethical issues that have been raised, issues about consent, privacy, they're all very important, but to some extent, through the history of the ethics programme and the Human Genome Project, the question's been the wrong question. It's been about, do you want to know, instead of, can you trust what you are told? So genetic prediction and prevention, I would argue, can harm health. You can give the wrong advice, the wrong people. You can confuse messages about healthy eating. Oh, I don't need to eat healthily because I've got the, I haven't got the heart disease gene, or I haven't got the a high risk for obesity. You can undermine public health approaches because what you're doing in effect is privatising health information and lifestyle information. So instead of having a government telling you you've got to eat five a day, you've got a whole series of companies saying, well, if you have these genes, you've got to take these supplements. If you have these different genes, you should have cholesterol low and margarine. And what you tend to see, and Teresa Marteau's research on people's reactions tends to reinforce this, is you're going to get people more likely probably to buy products and think that their risk can only be addressed in a medical way. So you're medicalising genetic risk, and that may be towards buying functional foods and supplements, or it may be pharmaceuticals. And in doing so, you also divert resources into this as the preventive strategy for health. So I would argue all those harms, some of which are more on a population level than on an individual level, that individual anxiety can be very important, particularly for some more feared diseases. All those reasons suggest that it is important to assess, before they go to market, the validity and utility of the tests. And I would argue that's because we have a very clear example of market failure, because there's an imbalance of information. People are entirely dependent on the companies to tell them the interpretation of their sequence. Some are being much more responsible than others. How do you know? How do you know whether what you're being told is even true in a very basic sense? So often companies don't even provide the details of what they're testing, but even if they do, how can somebody analyse that information? Even a doctor can't do it, and even an expert may be unable to do it because the literature is so vast, changing so quickly, unless you have a system in place. And the PR context, and I think this is very important, makes it hard for people to even be aware that problems might exist. So people aren't necessarily going to ask the questions that they need to ask, because they don't know that genetic information could ever be anything other than perfectly true, because that's what they've been told. They've been told it's a code, they've been told it tells you your genetic risk. And by that I don't mean that people necessarily interpret it deterministically and think, oh, I've got the gene, I'm going to get that. I think it's a question about the distinction between knowing the sequence and how that sequence is going to be interpreted. It does have health implications, and by definition, tests of poor utility can harm health. That's what utility means. It's a weighing up of the pros and cons of implementing a particular screening program or a particular test. It's not definitive. Of course, you always have expert arguments about exactly where you draw that line, but that is what tests of poor utility are. They're tests that are thought to do more harm than good. And of course, there's a whole raft of important issues about privacy and consent, and as I raised earlier, especially for children and even babies who, if you take some of the company's views, should be sequenced at birth without any say in that at all. So finally, just before I wind up, why single out genetic tests? It's often questioned, why focus on this? I think one of the key issues is because of that genohype. It is because of that background that people are accessing this information. And years of misinformation as well in the press about we've discovered the gene for this, that and the other, many of which were, you know, the VDR gene linked with osteoporosis was on the front page of Nature, no longer being marketed by quite a few companies, no longer thought to have a statistically significant association. It's also very easy to test for, and there are many other tests where you do have to go to a doctor to get the sample taken or whatever. You can send with a mouse swab, you can get tested for thousands of variants, even potentially your whole genome, without any interaction with another human being. We know mis-selling already exists, we know strong vested interests already exist, and there's a key sort of scientific difference in this issue of testing fixed risk factors. So if you test the cholesterol levels and you have an intervention that can lower your cholesterol levels, that's easier to assess and deal with than testing a gene which you're saying, we're not actually changing this gene, but you can have an intervention that works better for you than it does for people without that gene. That's a much more complicated thing to assess. And it also has social implications because your category, your risk category, is based on something integral to you, so there is potential for stigma and discrimination. Most unregulated tests won't be valid or useful. It's impossible for non-specialists to make these kind of assessments unless they have an enormous amount of time. I'm not saying people are stupid. I think if somebody really wanted to go through all the literature and learn all about it, they could, but they need to spend years doing it. And it's a dual-use technology, so there is another potential vested interest there around biosurveillance and getting access to genetic information in databases and samples by the police or the security services. It has very important implications for families, of course, as well, around the consent issue, but also around shared information. And so my conclusions are, there is an existing actual protocol under the European Convention on Biomedicine and Human Rights, the Council of Europe's convention, which is already written there, which is saying that tests should not be marketed until criteria are met for clinical validity and utility, and which requires appropriate counselling depending on the circumstances. So those are the kind of principles that I think we need to have in place, and then we need to look at bringing regulations such as the Diagnostics Directive that Stuart's going to talk about, I'm sure, into line with that. And company, the owners should be on the companies to provide the data. So there have been claims that this should all be done by public-private partnership. Yes, if you have some prior evidence, so that's going to be a really likely to be useful test, like, for example, the warfarin test, where it's going to be important to do that assessment to find out whether or not it should be rolled out across the NHS. But don't pour loads of money into trying to assess a test to predict whether you should quit smoking or not, because really you should quit smoking or not. You should quit smoking, you know, on health grounds, regardless of what genes you have. And I think, finally, a technology is that stepping back from regulation, we need to have this overview assessment, the kind of thing that Andrew Wilkie was talking about the likely costs and benefits. I think we do have enough evidence now, not to predict the details, but to say, is mainstreaming genetics across the board, sequencing all our genomes, likely to be cost-effective, to be beneficial for health? And really, we've been looking gene by gene at what we can put into the health service instead of stepping back and saying, is that really the future? Thank you.